From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Tomorrow marks 2 years since the mob of Trump supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol and members of Congress attempted to subvert the presidential election. Since then, hundreds of men and women have been arrested and charged for breaching the Capitol, many of whom are from Illinois. Meanwhile, all throughout last year, you could tune into hearings from the House committee charged with investigating the January 6th insurrection. Let's listen to a snippet from a compilation of the committee's findings that was presented during its final public hearing last month.
It was clear that it was escalating and escalating quickly. So then when that tweet, the Mike Pence tweet, was sent out, I remember us saying that that was the last thing that needed to be tweeted at that moment. It felt like he was pouring gasoline on the fire by tweeting that.
They gained access to the second floor, and I've got public about 5 feet from me down here below.
They are on the second floor, moving in now. You may want to consider getting out and leaving now. Copy.
The members of the BP detail at this time were starting to fear for their own lives. There were calls to say goodbye to family members, so on and so forth.
Approximately 40 feet. That's all there was. 40 feet between the vice president and the mob.
Donald Trump and his allies and supporters are a clear and present danger to American democracy.
That event has left a scar on our democracy, and its effects are still being felt today. We asked our texting group about this. Many of you agreed. Charles in Champaign said, still many people in denial and ignorant of specifics. The issue will not die so long as Trump gets free coverage by the press. And Ricardo in Urbana said, for those promoting that view, we must ask, what is the punishment for those so unsatisfied in our country that they're willing to break it down rather than accept the opposition winning? Right now, American politics is at its most divisive in probably generations. In the House of Representatives, the representatives-elect are in limbo, waiting for their term to start as lawmakers struggle to decide who should be the next Speaker of the House. Here to help us reflect on what we've learned in the last 2 years is Jonathan Alter. He's a Chicago native, MSNBC analyst, co-host of SiriusXM's Alter Family Politics. He also writes the Old Goats newsletter. And he's also the first person we spoke with here on the 21st Show after the insurrection. So we're glad to have him back to continue that conversation. Jonathan, welcome. Thanks for being here again.
Always a pleasure. Good to be with you.
Also with us today is John Seidel. He's the federal courts reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. He's been covering the stories of Illinoisans charged with participating in the insurrection. John, welcome back to the 21st Show to you as well.
Be glad to be here.
And listeners, we want to invite you to join our conversation today, as ever, at 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. Do you think Americans have sufficiently reckoned with the events of January 6th, 2021? Have enough people been brought to justice? And should this issue continue on in our elections and our politics? 800-222-9455 is the number. So, Jonathan, I want to begin with you. The Klein Center, which is a nonpartisan political science research center here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, it recently categorized the January 6th insurrection as an attempted dissident coup d'etat. And more recently than that, even said it was also an attempted auto coup d'etat. What do you think of those categorizations?
I think the latter one is more accurate because this was a different kind of coup attempt. Normally around the world, when there are coup d'etat, they are the military taking over the government, throwing out the civilian leadership, and staging a coup to bring in a new government. That was not what happened in this case. It was, for the first time in American history, an incumbent president who attempted to use illegal means to stay in office, even though he had lost the election. And was eventually willing to sanction force in that coup effort. And so calling it an auto coup to reflect that it was done by an existing government to stay in power rather than to push a government out of power is the accurate way to assess it.
John, I want to bring you into this conversation now, because obviously part of that, what happened that day, a big part of it is the everyday people who were walking into the Capitol, as well as people who were sort of dedicated militia persons. And we can break down some of those distinctions later. But you've been following the stories of Illinoisans connected with the insurrection. Do you see language like that, like coup, playing a role in those cases?
You know, not so much directly in the Illinois cases, which, yes, I've found important to cover to let people know what's happening to their fellow citizens here in Illinois and what role they played in the event. And just to get snapshots of the individuals here, what we haven't seen much of in Illinois are samples of the larger conspiracy. We have one Proud Boy who has been charged and has pleaded guilty and is waiting sentencing here in Illinois. But there's yet to be any allegation that he was doing anything more than just following what was being said by the leadership of the Proud Boys online. He heard that they were all going to dress in black, so he decided to dress in black and come along for whatever happened on that day. So we haven't seen too many examples of that here. We're still new information is still coming to light, though. There's a trial of a Chicago man coming up who was talking about allegedly revolution when he was within the Capitol, as many people were. And so some of the more serious language is starting to come out, but we haven't seen so much of it here.
Well, John, maybe you can put some numbers on this. How many Illinoisans have been charged? How many have been convicted? Where do things stand with regard to that?
Sure. We've had 35 Illinois residents that we're aware of who have been charged so far in connection with January 6th. As things stand right now, about half of those cases have been resolved. People have been, I don't think any have gone to trial at this point, so they've been resolved with guilty pleas and sentencings. A lot of them are misdemeanor cases. A lot of them have led to probation. We did just last month have the longest prison sentence handed down to an Illinoisan. A man named Matthew Castle from Ottawa got an 18-month prison sentence. It's the most severe we've seen so far. Up until then, we've seen people being handed a few days, a few weeks, maybe a month in jail. But that's about it. So 35 total, about half of them are still pending. We do have trials that are on the schedule. I mentioned Kevin Lyons from Chicago has a stipulated trial set for next month. I think the first traditional jury trial is for a man named Thomas Adams, who's due to go to trial in March.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with John Seidel of the Chicago Sun-Times, who's a federal courts reporter there and has been covering the cases of Illinoisans charged in relation to the January 6th insurrection. And also Jonathan Alter, longtime political journalist, author, and MSNBC analyst, among many other appointments he has. And we're reflecting back on what we've learned in the last 2 years since the insurrection. And Jonathan, I want to ask you about these different types of conspiracies. I think it was Ben Wittes of the Lawfare podcast. I've heard him making this point that there were multiple January 6th conspiracies, right? Certainly the people around President Trump and the president himself allegedly, you know, pursuing these pseudo legal ideas to reject electors from certain states. You also have the sort of militia people. Some have dismissed them as Mule Team 6 type people, but, you know, they're wearing Kevlar vests and helmets, bringing handcuffs into the Capitol with them. And then, of course, there were the more, you know, sort of normal everyday Trump supporters who maybe walked into the Capitol or left the rally. Do you see, can you talk about those distinctions and how we are thinking back on that day and how to approach people who were involved or just supported the president throughout that time?
Well, you know, obviously there's a big difference between committing a conspiracy to overturn an election, like a number of those who we've come to know from the January 6th committee investigation, and somebody who was manipulated and fooled by President Trump into believing a lie. And those people, you know, as John just indicated, some of them are just going to jail for a few days or weeks for, you know, minor charges. And obviously, you know, you can't throw them in the same bucket with co-conspirators, which is what they were. And we now have voluminous evidence of this. So you do want to make those distinctions, but all of them were poisoned by the former president of the United States. Their minds were poisoned. They were manipulated. They were lied to. And for those who were not violent on January 6th, but just chose to believe Trump, I guess I have a little bit of pity because they, you know, they were taken in. But anybody who actually entered the Capitol, much less battled the Capitol police, they, you know, when they did enter the Capitol, they knew they were doing something wrong. There wasn't any confusion about that. And to the extent that they were identified, they need to be punished.
And I'm not looking to sort of have suggest that that's not the case. I guess what I'm wondering is reaching the people who still, you know, are into the, maybe they did not, you know, directly participate in that, or they don't advocate violence, but they still somehow don't think the election was legitimate. And there just seems to be, you know, we're divided by these realities in America, where depending on which, you know, cable news network you watch, you may have a very different view of what happened that day, among many other topics, right?
Yeah, no, this is a huge problem in our country right now. But it's important to recognize that it's not just a matter of a difference of opinion. Oh, I think the election, you know, was stolen from Trump. No, I think actually it was Trump who was trying to overturn the results of a legitimate election. It's just a difference of opinion. No, no. In any kind of small d democratic society, you have to have a respect for facts and truth, and not just say, well, people are getting a different truth. No, there aren't different truths in this case. It was a legitimate election that Donald Trump illegitimately tried to overturn with his big lie. And the people who believed the big lie, and the big lie is not an allegation, it's a statement of fact. What he said happened did not happen. The election was not stolen from him. And he knew that. He knew that he had lost. And there was a lot of evidence in January 6th, which will be very important when he's indicted, which I believe he will be. I should say if he's indicted, to stick to the facts, but I believe he will be indicted. And so when the case is brought against him, his state of mind will be very important. And one of the big things that we've learned in the last few months is that he knew he had lost. He knew he was lying, even though he often has a hard time distinguishing between truth and fiction. As to all of the people who still believe the lie, this goes to a deeper problem we have in this country, where our media has been politicized and people don't trust institutions anymore. They obviously don't trust the media sources that don't validate their views. And that is a problem on both the left and the right. All of that, those of us who are in the business can do, and those of us who have any connection to thinking about or commenting on these events, all that we can do is try to urge people to look at the evidence. And this is where January 6th committee becomes really important. So on my Substack newsletter, which is called Old Goats, since I'm such an old goat myself, I did, you know, a recap of all 10 of those hearings. And whether you read me or you read the report itself or the executive summary of the report, I just urge anybody listening who might still think that, you know, Trump was right, the election was rigged, I do think you owe it to yourself to read the evidence on the other side, to listen, just listen to somebody like Liz Cheney and really ask yourself, is she making all this up or is she on to something? Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is important for people on the left to do too. It's important for them to listen to people on the right with an open mind.
Yeah.
But if you approach these things in an open-minded way, you can get closer to the facts and the truth.
Yeah. All right. We need to take a break. We're going to continue this conversation. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are 2 years after the insurrection on January 6th when a group of former President Trump, then President Trump's supporters, stormed the U.S. Capitol building attempting to subvert the election. Also members of Congress participating in that plot, as well as a number of legal advisors to the then president, all in service of, as we've been saying, the big lie that somehow the election was not fairly won by Joe Biden, which again is not the case. The election was fairly won by Joe Biden. We're talking about this with Jonathan Alter, who is a Chicago native, writes the Old Goats newsletter. You can find that on Substack. He hosts Alter Family Politics on Sirius XM Radio. He's also an analyst on MSNBC. Also, John Seidel, federal courts reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. 800-222-9455 is the number if you want to join our conversation. And I know some stations are probably coming back online with us after having taken live coverage of President Joe Biden. So still time to join our conversation today at 800-222-9455. John Seidel, I want to ask you about that idea of people being saying that, you know, they were taken in by the former president in terms of the insurrection. Do you see that sort of sense of remorse from the Illinoisans who have been arrested and prosecuted for their roles that day? And you know, to the extent the courts can weigh that, do they seem to be sincere and taken as sincere by the courts?
Yeah, I do see that. I see evidence of people who have been quoted either in social media accounts or on videos talking about how the election was being stolen. We have to take back our country, things of that nature, who then at sentencing acknowledged that they were taken in, they were fools. There are various phrases that have been used at sentencing. One case that comes to mind is a suburban couple. It's another case of two individuals who I do believe they entered the Capitol through a broken window. There's no doubt that they knew they shouldn't have been entering the Capitol, but nonetheless, it was a case in which they entered the Capitol, they wandered around for a bit, and then they left. Between the time of their arrest and their sentencing, their attorney asked them to read, basically gave them a reading list to expand their point of view, and just get a sense of life from another person's perspective, and that really seemed not only it seemed to have an impact on them, but it also I think had an impact when it came time for sentencing. The judge seemed to take it into account, and I think I've heard that same judge make references to that sentencing and other sentencings of Illinoisans. So, yeah, we do see some of that. We, I, frankly, have also seen people double down on the views that they held at the time of January 6th. They pleaded guilty, acknowledged they did something they shouldn't have done, but yet still feel a lot of anger and frustration and a feeling that other people are getting away with things while they're being punished and sent to jail, even though it may be for a short period of time.
John Seidel, you've noted to our producer that a lot of the judges in these cases have been handing out probation instead of jail time. Why is that significant?
Well, the one case where I found it rather remarkable, I mean, it's significant for multiple reasons, but I think in talking to the producer, what I was pointing out, there was one particular case of a couple, I believe it was Christopher and Tina Logsdon from downstate, from Cesar, Illinois, downstate, in which there was an option of a short period of jail time or a lengthy period of probation. And in that case, I think both the judge and the prosecutors stressed that if they had to choose one or the other, they would choose probation. And I think the Logsdons actually got 3 years of probation. And the reason that that was actually considered the better option was because it meant that the Logsdons would remain on probation at the time of the next presidential election. These are, again, people who have no criminal history, law-abiding citizens up until the point of January 6th, and then they participate in this event. And it seemed important in that hearing to make sure that they remained under court supervision at the next election. And I think Tina Logsdon is one of those who she's actually the very person I was thinking about when I talked about people who remain very frustrated with the state of affairs in this country. The judge told her, no matter how upset you get in 2024 or into 2025, this is not something that you can do again. Otherwise, there are going to be more severe penalties. And I found that very interesting. I really hadn't heard that conversation come up in any of the other sentencings I'd covered. I'm not sure if Jonathan's heard that, but I just thought that was an interesting tool that the judge decided to use, just not only to, you know, some sort of punishment for what had already happened, but also in an attempt to try and prevent it from happening again.
Yeah, Jonathan, go ahead. What about that?
I'm fascinated by that, John, and I had not heard that. That sounds to me like a very wise judge. A question I would have for you is, what was on the reading list that was used? I guess it was in another case. That helped open the eyes of some of the defendants?
Good question. I'm trying to pull that up right now. Let's see if I've got that on my fingertips. Oh, Amy Schubert, she told the judge that she read Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson. Oh. She described it as detailing the vast unfairness in the legal system. She read Slavery by Another Name by Douglas Blackman. And she also, I don't have a citation to a particular book here, but she said that she learned about blockbusting, which she described as the practice of introducing black homeowners into previously all white neighborhoods in order to spark white flight. So those were some of the topics and books that they read.
That's also super interesting to me, rather than, you know, assigning like, an essay by Liz Cheney or a floor speech by Adam Kinzinger, they chose an indirect way into influencing the thinking of some of these folks. And I'm fascinated that it was a racial dimension that the judge chose.
Yeah, that is fascinating. You know, let's go big picture on this then, Jonathan. I wonder, as I'm just checking the news wires and the different news websites, there is still not a Speaker of the House. And, you know, we're also looking ahead to the next presidential election. Obviously, as we heard, some of these defendants, there are judges who want to make sure they are sort of have a legal sword of Damocles hanging over their heads to prevent them from doing again what they tried to do after the 2020 election. Do you think are we in a better place? And I kind of know the answer to this, having read your Substack newsletter, why you think 2022 was a very good year. Are we on the right track?
I think we are. Now, we're not out of the woods in terms of protecting democracy, but that's a perpetual struggle that we've had all through American history. Things seemed quite grim in the aftermath of January 6th because Donald Trump was able to reassert control of the Republican Party thanks to Kevin McCarthy going to Mar-a-Lago and making, you know, peace with him after Trump had basically urged his supporters to go and kill not just the vice president, but certainly endanger somebody like Kevin McCarthy, who fled for his life. So that act, which I think will be remembered for a very long time, had really serious consequences in the last couple of years. And it looked as if the poison, the cancer of authoritarian Trumpism had metastasized throughout much of American political life. And it did to a certain extent, but the midterms were historic. And the most important part of the midterms were not that, you know, the Democrats added a seat in the Senate or, you know, narrowly lost control of the House. It's that the election deniers running statewide in battleground states, particularly Arizona and New Mexico and Nevada, lost. And that the Mastriano, who was running for governor of Pennsylvania, lost. So these people who were not believers in our system, who were authoritarians at heart, who believed that the only fair election was the one they won, they were defeated. And not only were they defeated, but they can most for the most part, they conceded, which is the central dimension to, you know, the peaceful transfer of power that our system is based on. And so these concessions by people like Herschel Walker, you know, very, very important. And we did not see election violence. We did not see the election deniers, you know, assembling a mob at state capitals or board of elections. We saw a peaceful, fair, legal midterm election. And that was very, very important for sustaining democracy. And then there were a couple of other things that have happened. There was a revision of the Electoral Count Act, which was the 19th century law that gave, you know, the Trump people a fig leaf to try to seize power through the vice president. And so that law was changed. It'll make it harder for authoritarians to use the certification process in Congress to seize power illegally. And there were a number of other things that were good news. So I think that at a certain point, we need to take good news when we get it, take yes for an answer. And we still have a lot of progress to go. I'm still nervous about the 2024 election, but things are headed in the right direction since November.
Only about 5 minutes left in our conversation. We're speaking with Jonathan Alter, a longtime political journalist, MSNBC commentator, writer of the Old Goats newsletter on Substack, and John Seidel, federal courts reporter at the Chicago Sun-Times, reflecting tomorrow is 2 years since the insurrection attempt at the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. You know, one of the things we asked our listeners in our texting group is, do you think enough people have been brought to justice? And I think inherent in that question is whether the right people have been brought to justice or enough of the right people. Ann in Urbana said, my greatest fear is that the DOJ won't prosecute the major offender, Trump, that people will lose interest and it will just melt away. Jonathan, you mentioned earlier you do think that President Trump will be prosecuted. Talk about why you think that's the case.
Well, I think, you know, we have an attorney general, Merrick Garland, who's from Illinois, by the way, a protege of the late Congressman Abner Mikva. And he has repeatedly said, on many occasions now, no person is above the law. And then he repeats it and he says, you know, how many times do I have to say this? No person is above the law. And so basically what the January 6th committee did in sending these criminal referrals was they said to the Department of Justice, okay, prove it. You know, if you're saying this, prove it. And the way to prove it is to prosecute Trump. Now, they have been in recent months, the pace of the investigation from DOJ has really grown. It's accelerated. At the beginning, it seemed like they really weren't going to prosecute him. Then a couple of things happened. One was there was a whole other case, the Mar-a-Lago documents case, where they're clearly moving toward an indictment. And a lot of revelations in the coup, auto coup case, the January 6th case. And they, you know, seized the phone of Jeffrey Clark and of John Eastman and some of the other conspirators. They've had a lot of testimony already before the grand jury, and there's more to come. So I think they are on track to a prosecution. That doesn't mean it's a sure thing, but there are a lot of Democrats who are a little bit despondent that there's going to ever be any justice for the higher ups. And I think they need to take more of a wait and see attitude. The wheels of justice grind slowly.
John Seidel, just a couple of minutes left. What are you watching for next in the cases you've been following? Are there still more shoes to drop, so to speak, more prosecutions to come?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen people. We saw yet another charge for an Illinois resident just a few weeks ago at the end of December. So these charges are still coming. Like I said, we've yet to see a trial yet. It looks like we may see some Illinoisans go to trial this year. And so obviously I'll be watching to see how that goes and what the results are, and also the sentences of some of these more serious cases that we've had here. I'll be watching for that as well as the bigger picture, as we've been talking about.
Yeah. And Jonathan Alter, about 30 seconds left. What are you watching for ahead? The January 6th committee is done now. We're waiting to see how divided the Republicans are heading into the next Congress. Certainly seems pretty divided, but what are you watching for next in this unfolding story of January 6th?
So I think, and I could be wrong about this, I think that an indictment, if there is an indictment, will come first in the Mar-a-Lago documents case, where they basically have Trump dead to rights. If he was convicted in that case, based on precedent, that doesn't necessarily mean you get jail time. So I'm not saying we're going to see him in an orange jumpsuit anytime soon. But I do think that 2023 is going to be a year where people get a sense that the higher ups, including Trump, will be held accountable for their behavior.
Well, hope maybe we can check in with you next January and see how 2023 went, if not sooner. Jonathan Alter is a publisher of the Old Goats newsletter on Substack. You can also see him on MSNBC and SiriusXM, where he's co-host of the Alter Family Politics Show. And John Seidel is federal courts reporter at the Chicago Sun-Times. Jonathan and John, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thanks.
More to come after a short break. Stay with us.